a White Rocket Instant Reaction Podcast. James Bond 24, Spectre.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear to the top.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. On this episode, a very hurried and rushed episode, I'm going to give you my immediate feedback reaction to the new James Bond movie, the 24th James Bond movie in the franchise, Spectre, starring Daniel Craig. Now, we have, I'm sure, a couple more episodes coming up in the not-too-distant future in which we will have guests on. I'm sure that John and I will be doing a Spectre-only episode coming up pretty soon, and we will go into much more depth. But for this one, I just want to give the immediate reaction just mere hours after I finally got to see it. And what a long wait it seemed to finally get to see it. It was open in Britain 2 weeks ago. And I've been on a spoiler avoidance ever since. And that reminds me, if you haven't seen the movie yet, I'm going to talk very briefly here at the beginning in non-spoiler terms, okay? That may still be more information than you want. I'm not going to give away any secrets or anything that's not really known before you see the movie, but I will say a couple of things about it up front, just in quality terms. And then I'll give you the warning that we're going to move into discussion of the actual plot and characters and development and the events. And so you probably, if you haven't seen the movie yet, at that point, you might want to step away and come back after you've seen it. All right. So for the non-spoiler portion, I gave this movie an A-. Now, I have very specific reasons that I gave it an A-. Which I'll get into in the spoiler section. But I'll just say that I thought it was, in terms of ranking it in general, it's definitely a top five Bond movie of all time. Depending on what you're looking for and what you like in a Bond movie, I have it definitely in the top five. If I were to rank it alongside the other Daniel Craig movies, I would say it is obviously much better than Skyfall. It's funny. Skyfall has really divided the fan base and the movie public. Some people think it was brilliant and a masterpiece and genius. I have no idea what movie those people were looking at because I thought Skyfall was riddled with errors and problems and malfunctions. And it just didn't make a lot of sense to me. I didn't like Skyfall a bit. I thought it suffered the same problem, Skyfall, that a lot of the movies that came out around that year did, which is a lot of stuff that looked good but didn't make any sense in terms of the characters and the plot. Star Trek Into Darkness suffered that problem. Prometheus suffered that problem, and on and on. This one's much better than that. This movie makes sense. It has a logical and consistent through plot, and the characters act the way you'd mostly expect characters, you know, human beings to act in these circumstances. So I would rate the Daniel Craig Bonds, Casino Royale is probably still the best just because it's a smaller movie. It's a tight, concise movie. It's an intense movie. But it has a lot of big scenes too. So I really do think Casino Royale has grown on me. I didn't like Casino Royale as much when I first saw it, because it almost, you know, you go through the poker game and that almost feels like it should be the end of the main story. And then you had that whole long extended bit in Venice, which seemed sort of anticlimactic to me. And it took reading the book and then watching the movie several more times for me to really get that if you don't go into Casino Royale with the expectation that the big poker scene is the climax of the movie, it's only like the halfway point. And if the movie's really about Bond's relationship with Vesper, then it all kind of makes a little more sense and works a lot better as a movie. And I think that also the parts of Quantum of Solace that work are the parts that tie back to Casino Royale, and they make Quantum of Solace a better movie than it otherwise would be. And so when you watch those two together, and I think we said it in John and my podcast earlier about the Craig movies, if you watch Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace back to back, just watch them bang bang back to back, it really makes for one really good movie if you can ignore all the South American dictator stuff, which I thought was kind of stupid. So this is better than Quantum of Solace, way better than Skyfall, not quite as good as Casino Royale. Now, that was disappointing to me because I wanted this movie to be the best Bond ever, right? We always want the new Bond to be the best one ever. And I got to say, for the first, you know, half of this movie, I really thought it had a chance. But there are a few things, which again, I'm going to go into in more detail in just a couple of minutes, that I think really sort of hold it back from being as good as Casino Royale, from being as good as some of the classic ones that you know, we all love so much. Otherwise, just in general terms, before the spoilers, I thought the cast was very good. I like that everybody gets a little something to do, you know. The characters that in classic days would be static, they'd be behind a desk, you know, or in a room and never get to move around, maybe get a little more to do. So I think that's all to the good. But overall, there are a few problems, and we'll get into that in just a minute. Okay, so at the end of the non-spoiler section, I would say this. If you're a big James Bond fan, if you know the history, if you know the lore, if you're really into the classic stuff, you know, going all the way back to the 60s, all the way back to Dr. No, in fact, you will like this movie a good bit. I think the reviewers that have been the most negative on it have no clue about James Bond, right? I mean, this is similar to what I said in my review of Avengers Age of Ultron. The people that like these two movies the least are the ones that don't know the history and don't understand why something's important, right? Something that people who actually know the characters and the history and the story, people, you know, stuff that happens in the movie, those people see those things and say, oh, that was awesome. Yeah, that makes sense because that connects to this and that connects to this. What a great idea. People that have no idea about the characters and no idea about the story, they watch these movies, Age of Ultron, Spectre, and they just don't get it. And so they think, well, why was that there? That was dumb. That was a waste of time. That was boring. I don't understand it, so I'm just going to criticize it. So if you know Bond, if you're a Bond fan, and I imagine most people listening to my show are at least to some degree Bond fans, you will like a whole lot of Spectre, a whole lot. Okay. Now, let's move on into the detailed spoilerific section, okay? So if you haven't seen the movie yet, go ahead and press pause here or press stop or whatever. Go see the movie and come back because now we're going to talk about it in more detail. Now, I don't have any detailed notes in front of me. I haven't written much of anything down. I'm just going to kind of go stream of consciousness off the top of my head for a few minutes here and talk about what is good and what's not so good about it, why I rate it an A-, why I don't rate it higher than A-, and where I think it fits into the Bond pantheon, okay? First off, I think this movie, if you remember the old light beer from Miller ads, right? This movie is everything I wanted in a Bond film and less, okay? It's got everything there. Craig does a fantastic job. He's grown on me a lot as Bond. I've gotten kind of used to him now, and his approach is very dour, I'm not having any fun as Bond sort of approach. I mean, he's the anti-Roger Moore. And I realize there are a lot of people out there, a lot of Bond fans out there, that love the idea of an anti-Roger Moore Bond. I get that. But, you know, this is one of the reasons that I think Sean Connery and Pierce Brosnan were such great Bonds, is that they could be deadly serious, but they could also have that twinkle in their eye and that little wink and that little smile that makes you realize this is a lot of fun. This is a gonzo action adventure story. It's not, you know, it's not anything really serious beyond just the surface. Whereas Daniel Craig and I guess the people around him making these movies, they've had to change the tone of the Bond movies in this decade, in the last decade, to be more dark and serious and less fun. And, you know, that serves some things well, because we did, you know, it is good to have a more dark and serious and grim and gritty Bond. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I don't mind, you know, look, we had the entire 70s and 80s for the wacky, goofy Bond, okay? The double taking pigeons and the sheriffs from Louisiana and all that. We had two decades of that. So I can take a couple of decades now of Bond being more Dark Knight and less, you know, 60s Batman. I can take that. But it does mean that there's never really much overt fun about it. There's thrills, there's danger, there's action adventure. But it's all so very, very serious, and Bond just seems to be the long-suffering, agonizing Bond rather than the happy-go-lucky Bond, right? So, in other words, if the earlier Bonds were like Spider-Man cracking jokes as he fights villains, this is more Chris Claremont's X-Men, oh God, we're all gonna die any second and it's all terrible. But there's something to be said for that. I do get it. Okay, so that leads me into my first sort of criticism, and I'm going to get this out of the way while it's on my mind, because again, I don't have any notes or anything much, so this is going to be a very stream of consciousness. I'm going to talk about the stuff that's good about it, the stuff I liked about it, but I'm going to also talk about the bad, and let me get this first sort of overall not good thing out of the way. I think that one of the problems with Spectre is a tonal problem. And that I really lay at the feet of Mendez. And that is this. when Mendez, I mean, cause this movie suffers from some of the same problems that Skyfall did. There's just so much other stuff that's so much better that it kind of makes up for it. But here's what I mean by that. This run of Bond movies, as I said, wants to be dark and serious. But Mendez is determined, especially in this one, to include stuff that honestly has become almost cartoonish. Now, I love that stuff. I love Blofeld. I love Spectre. I love the room full of evil Spectre agents. I love all that stuff. It's fantastic. It's wonderful. But it doesn't quite fit the tone of these current movies. And so the problem is, you have this strange sort of juxtaposition of almost a happy-go-lucky Bond villain throwing back to the 1960s with Donald Pleasance and Charles Gray, you know, and Telly Savalas. And on the other hand, you have this grim and gritty Daniel Craig Bond. And so it's almost like watching one of those Disney movies where half the characters are human beings and half of them are animated images, and it just never feels natural that the humans are interacting with the animated. You know, think like Roger Rabbit was the apotheosis of humans interacting with cartoon characters on screen, right? I mean, it never went, you know, that or Space Jam. Okay, you know what I'm saying? Those kind of movies. And so Spectre almost comes off like one of those where Bond and some of his people are the human being characters and the villains are more like cartoon characters. Now again, I don't have anything against cartoon character Bond villains. I love cartoon character Bond villains. You know, we go back and listen to the 7 episodes that John Ringer and I did in the last few months talking about how much we love the movies and love the villains, right? But the thing is, I'm just saying, when you combine classic Bond villains like this with this current incarnation of Bond, it's awkward. It just doesn't really quite seem to work. So from a purely objective standpoint, when I look at this movie, I think, yeah, you know, some things in Skyfall did work better, maybe, because they were things purely of Skyfall. They didn't reach back into Bond history and try to modernize and bring those things forward. Okay. Now, what Mendez does in this movie is he really reaches back into Bond lore and Bond history, and he brings a whole lot of stuff forward that we haven't seen in a long time. And that means that, yes, we get Blofeld. He reveals himself. Hey, I warned you a while ago that if you haven't seen the movie and didn't want spoilers, to switch off, okay? So, yeah, we get Christoph Waltz as Ernst Stavro Blofeld, but not really a convincing reason why he's Ernst Stavro Blofeld. We find out that Blofeld is the author of all of Bond's pain. We find out that Blofeld was behind all the stuff that happened in the 3 movies, which is all well and good, except that they, you know, the old saying, show, don't tell in a story, where you actually reveal things rather than just having somebody say them. Well, Blofeld just says, yes, I did all that stuff. But there's no supporting evidence. There's no flashbacks. We don't see like a flashback of, you know, Le Chiffre or the guy in Skyfall, like meeting with Blofeld in a black and white scene, you know, like, here is your $1 billion. Now go and make Bond's life miserable. You know, you don't get anything like that. He just tells us in an offhand manner. I mean, I could have walked up to Bond in this movie, if I were a character in this movie, and said, Mr. Bond, yeah, all that stuff that happened to you in the last 3 movies, I did that. That was all me, okay? And I would have had just as much, you know, legitimacy of saying that as Blofeld does. We have no reason to think, other than maybe, I mean, the only tenuous connection is Mr. White, but remember, Mr. White's connection was to Quantum. And unless I blink my eyes, you know, metaphorically for about a split second, I don't think we're ever told how Quantum fits into Spectre. You know, we were thinking it's a wholly owned subsidiary and we would get some kind of an explanation or something. We've been speculating on this for months now, if not years. And I don't think that it ever is definitively stated how Mr. White and Quantum have anything to do with Spectre. It's almost like they just changed the name and expect us to all think that that second movie was called Spectre of Solace. I guess maybe there must have been some kind of explanation there, because obviously Mr. White definitely has strong connections to Blofeld, but it's never made as explicit as at least I felt like it needed to be. It's alluded to, and then it's just sort of dropped. So that's unfortunate, at least to me, because I wanted to understand the connections. And I wanted to see the connections and feel the connections, some kind of flashback or something. But we don't get any of that. Let's see. So that was some of my problems with it. And honestly, those are my main problems. I mean, I think that it's more a realization of what we could have had and then disappointment of what we end up with. Because really all that Blofeld does in this movie on screen is he's sitting at the table being menacing, and that works very well. And then he's, you know, torturing Bond, but that scene's not really different from any other Bond torture scene we've had in the last several movies. I guess it was supposed to seem more horrific somehow, but it just kind of came across as creepy and all, but it just was another torture Bond scene. I don't think it had as much tension as when he was poisoned and had to go jumpstart his heart in his car in Casino Royale. And then there's the scene toward the end with the helicopter where Blofeld's in the helicopter and Bond, you know, shoots him down and goes after him on the bridge. Okay, so, and one other problem I had with it, while I'm sort of talking negative, then we're going to get into some of the positive stuff, okay? Because I really did, again, A-. I'm just showing you the things that kept it from being an A++++. But this is why it's an A-. The other problem I had is that Lea Seydoux's character, Madeline Swann, Mr. White's daughter, and gosh, it was good to see Mr. White. Madeline Swann, it seemed very contrived when she just randomly decides to leave him, you know, just long enough to fall into more trouble and then get back with him again at the end. But that's the problem I've had with both of Mendez's movies, Bond movies, is that a lot of stuff seems very contrived. That's especially a problem in Skyfall, as I said. Almost everything in Skyfall to me felt contrived. It has that Damon Lindelof effect that I always talk about, where things happen because they're cool or because they need to happen to serve the plot, not because they're logical actions a fully fleshed out character would take. I have that problem with an increasing number of movies these days, where you establish a character, the character acts a certain way, the audience comes to expect a certain pattern of behavior from the character, and then because the plot needs it, they just completely act in a different way for a scene or two, right? Just because they needed to. And that's an unfortunate, and I feel like it's a sort of a lazy screenwriting trend that has developed in the last few years. I'm sure, you know, that if you went back, you could find movies from since there have ever been movies the last 100 and something years that do that. But it really has jumped out to me with the big action, you know, summer tentpole movies of the last 5 or 10 years, because it's their one glaring weakness usually. And, you know, the effects are amazing, the cast is amazing, and then they just have this one glaring flaw, which is that the characters just behave completely irrationally for no other reason than because it serves the plot. Okay. Now, if I think of any other criticisms of this movie, I'll toss them in, because I want you to understand why I was sort of disappointed, right? And why it only got an A-. Now, let's kind of go through the movie and I'll tell you what I loved about it and what really, really worked. Okay. We start out with the gun barrel sequence. Oh, how good is that? We get the gun barrel sequence back again, really for the first time in the way that it's supposed to work. And that was fantastic. I believe the James Bond radio guys do a whole 45-minute episode last week just on that. That shows you how important that is to Bond fans. So we were very happy to have that back. The opening sequence. Oh, my goodness. John and I are planning on doing an episode just on opening sequences of Bond movies. You remember how we ranked all the Bond villains in a previous episode? We're going to go through and, I don't know, we're going to rank all the opening sequences, but we're going to like separate them into like the good, the bad, the ugly kind of thing and discuss them a little bit. I think that you Bond fans out there that like to listen to us talk about Bond, I think you, and a bunch of you, those have been some of our most successful episodes in terms of listeners, I think you're really going to enjoy that. So this opening sequence to me is up there in the top five easily up in the top five. It evokes, and I'm also, by the way, as we go along further here through the movie, I'm going to talk about the things from the past that this movie that Mendez is really trying to sort of dredge back up and bring out again. And this movie really worked as a 50th anniversary movie even better than Skyfall did, because with Skyfall he had a few very overt, you know, references to the past, but this movie is like Bond's greatest hits. It really is Bond's greatest hits from the last 53 years or whatever. So, okay. So that opening sequence is fantastic in Day of the Dead. It's evocative of Live and Let Die. Just like the movie poster of Bond in a black suit with a brown shoulder holster was very evocative of Roger Moore in Live and Let Die. I don't think Bond ever actually shows up in this movie looking like he did in that poster. I think that poster in retrospect was entirely Mendez just toying with the fans and saying, hey, look, he's Roger Moore in Live and Let Die. That doesn't actually happen in the movie, but isn't this cool to see Daniel Craig that way? So, yeah, you get that great action scene with the helicopter and the Zocalo in Mexico City and the Day of the Dead. Oh, it's fantastic. I love the bit where he's trying to shoot people across the alley in the hotel room or whatever, and he must have shoots a bomb. And the whole building comes down and you got all that. I mean, that's like cranking it to 11, really. So, and I also like how in more than one of the Daniel Craig movies, Bond tries to do what he's supposed to do, and he ends up blowing a bunch of stuff up and killing people that he didn't want to, and he tried really hard not to, you know, and in those cases, M is always like, you weren't supposed to do that, you idiot. Why did you do it that way? And Bond never says, well, I didn't mean to, right? He's just like, oh, well, you know, sorry. So I thought that worked kind of well in this one, too. It was a callback to the beginning of Casino Royale, where he chases the guy all over Madagascar and ends up blowing up an embassy and everything and killing the guy. So there's a good reference there. It's to Casino Royale and to the Live and Let Die. And it was a fun opening sequence. I don't know what people have a problem with about the title sequence. I had a feeling that this theme song, which has been heavily criticized, The Writings on the Wall by Sam Smith, I thought that it was going to end up being a very appropriate one to the material in question, and I think it was, right? Because this was possibly the most introspective Bond movie ever, if not in a long time. And so a slower, heavier, more personal Bond song worked in a way that a Goldfinger or a Live and Let Die, you know, song just wouldn't have fit the tone right. So I was perfectly fine with the song. I think it's going to go on to be a classic. I think the opening credits bit in whole was pretty good. And you saw the tentacles, which is, you know, somebody said it reminds them of Octopussy, so maybe we can throw an Octopussy reference in there too, but really it's the tentacles of Spectre, okay? How hard is that to figure out after he finds the ring? Love the ring, by the way. Love the callback to the Spectre guys wearing a ring. That was fantastic. Then I'm not going to break down the entire movie scene by scene, but I'm going to go through some things I thought were really really effective and really good, and what they referred to. And I'm sure I missed a bunch. So, you know, I'm sure there are people out there that have watched the movies way more than I have and caught even more references than I did. And that's great. Let me flip over to the plot page for a second. Yeah. You've got the whole business with Moriarty, Andrew Scott as Max or C, setting up the surveillance state system and bringing other countries into it. I thought he was a great choice for that. He did a great job. You don't hire Moriarty and then not have him do Moriarty things. And that's what they did. If you don't know my reference there, he's Moriarty on Sherlock, the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock that the BBC does. And I thought he was a really good choice. He did a great job as that. And it gave M something to do action-wise toward the end, which was cool. Monica Bellucci, right? We find out that, I love the idea that Bond is living in his apartment there. It's the first time I think we've seen Bond's apartment since Live and Let Die. He's in a much nicer looking place this time than he was in 1973, I gotta say. If you go back and watch Live and Let Die, that was a pretty yucky little flat that Bond lived in, but this is nice. But I love the idea that Moneypenny comes in and Bond, and she says, you know, did you just move in or something? And he's like, no. But yet his pictures are not hanging on the wall. You know how when people move into a house, they kind of lean their pictures against the wall in places where they want them to be when they have time to hang them. And Bond has just never had time to hang pictures. So his apartment looks like he just moved in yesterday, even though he's lived there for quite a while. I thought that was a nice touch. That really made sense. So we find out that M left a message. The Judy Dench M left a message for Bond, and he's of course going to, because we saw three movies of his relationship with her. So of course he's going to go and pursue that lead, which led him to Mexico City, and now leads him to Rome, where he goes to the funeral of the guy he killed in the helicopter. And that's where we get Monica Bellucci as Lucius Sciarra. And, you know, people complain that she wasn't in the movie enough. I thought it was fine. I didn't need any more of her than that. I thought it all went perfectly well. She's beautiful, as we would expect, and she's very serious and does a fine job with it. And I mean, what else did you need of her? She's there to forward the plot along to the next big scene. So that's fine. So then he goes to Austria, and we get the encounter with Mr. White. And I love this. I love the idea that Mr. White is holed up like a hermit in a cabin somewhere in Austria. And he's basically waiting to die because Blofeld is already, Inspector have already gotten to him. And his only concern at that point, and you get that great exchange between them. It's one of the great conversations in Bond history where he tells him, "You're a kite dancing in a hurricane, Mr. Bond," right? I mean, it's such a great connection to the first two movies in the Craig cycle, and I love it. And then you find out he's been poisoned, and so he's waiting to die, and he just wants his daughter to be safe. So Bond goes to find the daughter at the... They go to Austria. Yeah, they're still in Austria. So they go to Pisgloria. Oh, how cool was it to see Pisgloria again? I mean, if you don't know, this is the on Her Majesty's Secret Service location. And we get to go back up there. We see the cable car, which also gives a kind of a connection back to For Your Eyes Only, the sequence in the cable car and trying to lose people in a crowd of people in a cable car. But you also get the On Her Majesty's Secret Service deal. It would have been cool if there'd been a bunch of women in the waiting room waiting to see Lea Seydoux's character, with their allergies. But so he hooks up with Lea Seydoux there, and we get a nice bit in Austria. It's also too bad we didn't get a snow skiing sequence there, because that would have been cool if they had to escape on skis. That would have called back a bunch of movies, but that would have been too much. So they go to Morocco, to Tangier, and there's a great scene with Bond and the rat, where the little rat's crawling around the floor, and Bond kind of interrogates him just because he's so exhausted and drunk and everything. And then the rat leads him to the hole in the wall where he finds the secret room with the various material that he needs. And there was a great little bit where he finds the videotape of Vesper's interrogation back in Casino Royale. And it's really interesting because he picks it up and he looks at it like he really wants to watch it. You know, it's ringing bells for him. He's like, oh, this is Vesper's interrogation. And then Lea Seydoux says something to him and he sort of puts it down and is like, no, you know, forget it, nothing. Because it's intriguing to him, but he has to put the past aside. He can't go back and dwell on the past. He moves on. And that was, I thought, a really powerful little moment that a lot of people probably missed, I'm afraid. So then they get on the train, and we get this awesome Bond on a train sequence. How long has it been since we saw Bond on a train? This is a callback to several great Bond movies where he's on the train and he fights the bad guy. I mean, you know, everybody thinks of the From Russia with Love sequence with Red Grant, but there was also the Live and Let Die sequence with Teehee on the train, and there's also, I believe, a sequence in The Spy Who Loved Me on a train with Jaws, right? So Bond on a train is always fun simply because you have several factors. You have Bond, a girl, and a villain in a very enclosed space, and they usually smash out the window. And there's danger that way, too, from high-speed travel, you know, with an open window. So so you get lots of fun things swirling around in a train fight. And that's awesome to see another train fight. I love that. They end up meeting with Q and finding the connections to Oberhauser and Spectre and all that. I'm sorry, that was right before that. Again, I just saw it last night, and it's all kind of a jumble in my mind. But the big fight with Mr. Hinks, I don't think they ever actually call him Mr. Hinks in the movie, do they? And by the way, speaking of Mr. Hinks, I thought that Dave Bautista was great. He's right up there among the best Bond henchmen. I challenge you to find anything about Dave Bautista and his performance and his character that doesn't rank him up alongside the greatest of the Bond henchmen. But here's the interesting thing. He wasn't just an odd job, Jaws, dumb henchman. He actually comes in and challenges for the role that that Sciara vacated by being killed. And he takes that spot from the guy that was sitting in the chair. And that means, I mean, I'm not entirely sure what level inspector that guy was supposed to be, but he's at the other end of the table. I kind of wondered if he was number two, like Largo in Thunderball was number two to Blofeld's number one, which made me wonder if Mr. Hinks was actually supposed to be more like Largo and be the number two guy inspector at that point, or if he's just sitting at the end of the table because he's the point of discussion of that, you know, of that topic, you know. So in other words, and I've yet to see anybody address this, I'm asking the question, was Mr. Hinks auditioning to be number two, or was the seat at the table where they were fighting, was that just because they were the topic of conversation, and so like if number 17 was being talked about, they'd have a number 17 sitting there at the foot of the table? I don't know, but that would kind of shed more light on Mr. Hinks' character. And again, did they ever even call him Mr. Hinks, or do we just know that from the credits? I don't know. But anyway, I thought Mr. Hinks was great. He's one of the best henchmen supporting villains ever. Lived up to, you know, everything we've ever seen from one of those characters. Then we end up at the meteor crater, and which is a big Spectre lair. Now, the one thing I didn't like about the meteor crater lair, I love the idea of a meteor crater lair. That's great. But I'm sure it was a callback to the volcano crater lair of Blofeld in You Only Live Twice. But the volcano crater seemed big and spacious. It had an architecture to it. It had an ambiance to it. It had a sense of vastness and space and power that there was this villain with his army. Whereas the meteor crater base in this movie, it never sold me, right? It never convinced me that it was anything other than a set and a couple of buildings. It felt not really different from the base in Skyfall. It felt not really different from that glass building in the desert in Quantum of Solace. It just felt like it never felt like a big evil villain lair, which I think is what Mendez wanted us to see it as, right? It never had room to breathe and make us think, oh, a giant evil villain base inside a crater, how awesome. No, it was just felt like a couple of rooms. It could have been a couple of hotel rooms, honestly. So that was disappointing to me, but I give Mendez credit for trying to revive the idea of the arch villain with some kind of a cool base inside some natural or, you know, geological formation. So that's cool, even though it never totally sold me. So we get the great callback to Dr. No, right? Where the villain leads Bond in like they're going to a resort. You know, everybody knows that he's prisoner of the villain now. Everybody knows he's been captured by the villain, he and the girl, and yet there's this pretense of, you know, welcome, Mr. Bond. Would you like some champagne? Come this way, please. I mean, that's classic Bond. That's Dr. No and pretty much every villain after Dr. No. And even to the point that they have rooms that they're provided, at least they didn't randomly get knocked out this time like they did in Dr. No, right, where Dr. No puts something in the coffee that knocks them out just for no reason. Why does he knock them out? Don't know. They wake up later and pick right back up where they were. No reason to knock them out. But in this movie, they don't get knocked out, fortunately, because that made no sense. And we get the great callback to Dr. No also, where they leave a dress for the lady to put on. And I have to say, I was very impressed with Lea Seydoux in that dress. She looks marvelous. It reminded me of in Dr. No, Ursula Andress putting on the sort of kimono or the Chinese dress that Dr. No has put out for her. That was just neat, and I thought that looked really nice on her. It really worked. It was very effective, I thought. Gave some character and color to that whole bit. Now, we get the torturing of Bond, And honestly, this didn't work that great for me either. I mean, I liked Oberhauser being Blofeld and revealing, you know, I'm the author of all your pain and everything. I liked all that happening. That worked okay. But the actual being strapped in a chair and having a drill, like a needle-sized drill drilling into you, to me wasn't that much worse than what was done to Pierce Brosnan in Bond 19, The World Is Not Enough. I thought it wasn't much worse than the torturing that Bond got from Le Chiffre. It probably wasn't as bad as what Le Chiffre did to him in the chair, right? Every time Bond ends up strapped into a chair, bad things happen. And this, to me, I was never convinced it was that much worse than anything else. Plus, it didn't seem to have any bad effect on him, even though Blofeld was standing there telling him, oh, this is going to do horrible things to you. And then it doesn't do anything to him, really, other than make him go, ah, you know, but so did everything else, you know, strapped to a table with a laser coming toward his crotch, you know. I did expect Blofeld to say, I don't expect you to talk, I expect you to die, but he didn't, but that's okay. Little on the nose. Okay, so they escape, which was kind of an odd escape. He has a watch that Q gave him, and Q had told him it tells its secret power is that it can tell the time, which was, I thought, funny. But Q also alludes to it does something else, and I guess it just that it blows up. So he somehow manages to get it off, give it to Lea Seydoux, and Lea Seydoux throws it at Blofeld, and it blows up. And the neat thing is, I have to admit, when we see Blofeld later, he's gone full Donald Pleasance, right? He's full on Donald Pleasance. He's got the scar on his eye, on his face and through his eye. That reminds me. When Bond is in the chair being tortured, we get Christoph Waltz's Blofeld. We get him in the Nehru jacket or the, you know, I guess it's a Nehru jacket, the collarless jacket. It's not the light gray jumpsuit version that Blofeld made famous Donald Pleasance and Charles Gray. It's a darker version, but it works, right? I mean, it's so evocative of You Only Live Twice. And we see the cat. Oh, we get the cat. You'll remember when John and I talked about this movie a couple of months ago about this movie and about the previous Craig movies, I said something to the effect of, if it's got the cat, remember we talked about, do we want the cat to actually be in it? Do we want a little cameo by the cat? Do we want the cat walking around the background? I thought there was like 70% chance no cat, 30% chance cat walks by in the background, 0% chance Blofeld actually interacts with the cat. Ladies and gentlemen, Blofeld interacts with the cat. He picks it up. He pets it. Of course, it's funny. He actually picks the fur off of his black jacket after he does. But we get the cat. I was so excited. I jumped up and down in my seat in the theater. I was so excited when we got the cat. So if nothing else, I give this movie top marks and Mendez top marks for including the white cat. That was I know that many of you think that it's ridiculous, you don't care, and you're wondering why I'm spending so much time here on this show talking about it, but the cat is just a symbol of everything that is Blofeld and Spectre. Go back and watch all the 1960s movies all the way through Diamonds Are Forever, 1971. The cat is so important to the identity of Blofeld and Spectre, and this really, for me, just completed the picture that he was supposed to be Blofeld. That made me thrilled. Okay, so they blow up the meteor crater base, which wasn't entirely clear to me. I mean, blowing up one thing makes the whole thing blow up. You know, usually there's a self-destruct that the villain pushes, and I got the sense that maybe that's what happened here because you saw the black SUVs pulling out in the background when it starts blowing up. So it may have been that Blofeld went ahead and hit the, you know, self-destruct button before he hopped in the SUV and took off to escape. That takes us into the last bit where Bond and Swan hook up with M, Bill Tanner, and Q, and Moneypenny, and all of them in a little team. It's almost like Doc Savage and his team now. They go to arrest Andrew Scott, Max, C, whatever you want to call him, they go to arrest him because the what they call the Nine Eyes, the world surveillance thing is about to happen, is about to go online at midnight. And that's a neat touch. I like that it's the world surveillance type thing that's the big, you know, evil plot here that ties us into some of the stuff from the Batman films. It ties us into current world headlines, you know, everything from WikiLeaks to the idea of the drones and the surveillance state that we're dealing with these days. Ubiquitous law enforcement and surveillance, you know, I've touched on that before with, you know, talking about Werner Vinge and stuff like that. So that was a pretty cool, I thought, evil plan rather than a laser in space or something. I think that global surveillance technology is a very realistic and very real danger, you know, and that's something that certainly was, if it fell into the wrong hands, or even if it didn't, but certainly here, if it falls into Blofeld's hands. So they get ambushed, Bond gets taken away, M escapes, which is kind of a neat twist. They go after C, and M gets a great battle with C, and C gets killed. Bond ends up in the old MI6 building, which is totally, you know, hollowed out and is just a ruin after what happened in Skyfall. And Bond goes inside there, and Bond has to find Lea Seydoux before the building blows up. They do there's a great bit where he notices that the ceiling is held up with a kind of a mesh to keep things from falling from above and onto people's heads, you know. And so when he finds Lea Seydoux at the top of the building, they just jump over the railing, so to speak, and land on that netting. That was pretty neat. I was like, what are they doing? And it was a very cool surprise to see they land on that netting. I thought that was a really neat scene. And then we get the big finish where they end up in the little boat, very similar to the one that Pierce Brosnan used at the beginning of The World Is Not Enough. That was great. I loved seeing that little boat. You'll remember that the original Q, it was his fishing boat, and Bond took it out and wrecked it. So we see another one of those little boats. It wasn't black, though, but it was a similar kind of little boat, and he chases the helicopter of Blofeld, and yeah, would he be able to shoot down a helicopter like that? You know, it's a James Bond movie. He can do anything. So, of course he does. So he shoots down the helicopter. There's no other way for him to bring it down, so he had to. Right? I mean, you know, if you want to play screenwriter here, tell me how else, with nothing but his sidearm, does Bond bring down an escaping helicopter? What else could they have done? I mean, does he happen to have a missile launcher and he jumps over the railing or something? Or maybe there's a, you know, maybe he opens up a case on the little boat and there's already weapons supplies on the boat, and one of them is like a grenade launcher or a surface-to-air missile. You know, why not? Q might have put that on his fishing boat. Who knows? But in any case, you know, they contrive that Bond shoots down the helicopter. Bond drives the boat up on the bridge. Blofeld's crawling out, his legs all messed up. And that was an interesting thing, too, because we got Bond fighting Blofeld involving a helicopter, which is evocative of the beginning of For Your Eyes Only, which was the last time we saw Blofeld when Bond dropped him into a smokestack. So, although we didn't call him Blofeld in that one, he was the guy in the wheelchair. So we end up with a Blofeld that may be in a wheelchair in the future, and has the scarred eye, just like, Donald Pleasance. And, Bond chooses not to kill Blofeld, which, you know, honestly, that felt contrived to me too, because Bond has no problem shooting people on a regular basis. Why wouldn't he shoot this guy that's been the architect of all of his pain? There's only one reason that Bond doesn't shoot Blofeld there, and that's so Blofeld can come back in future movies. And you know what? If you had told me before I saw the movie, I'd have been very upset, obviously, with the spoiler, but if you had told me before I saw the movie that, yes, Christoph Waltz is Blofeld, yes, he has the cat, and at the end, he's still alive so he can come back for future movies. I would have been thrilled at the prospect of more Blofeld, more Spectre. Honestly, at the end of this movie, I wanted Bond to kill him. Because I don't think I want any more of this Blofeld and this Spectre. I like Spectre. I like Christoph Waltz. I like him playing Blofeld. But after everything that happens in this movie, I don't know that we need any more, you know, really. I mean, where else do you go? Where else do you go with Blofeld after this? And I mean, clearly Mendez is not going to do any more Bond films. We don't even know if Daniel Craig is going to do the last one he's obligated to do or not. He may get out of that. So what that means is that Mendez was very politely leaving the toys, you know, on the table for the next director and writer. So that if, you know, we get a new Bond or we get a new director and we get a new director, they can have Blofeld if they want to. He's not dead. And that was cool. I'm just not sure I want. Let me put it this way. If we get Daniel Craig back for one more Bond movie, I don't want it to be Blofeld and Spectre again. Because we just had 2.5 hours of that. And I don't think I need another one. And I'm not sure how you would use Blofeld if he wasn't the main villain. I mean, I realize that in Thunderball and in Dr. No, you know, among others, I guess, from Russia with Love, Blofeld is in the movies, kind of, but he's not the main villain. But this would be backwards, right? Because he's the main villain in You Only Live Twice and Diamonds Are Forever. And that's after you've built up to showing him as the villain. I don't think I want to show him as the main villain and then back off and have him only as he was in Dr. No or only as he was in Thunderball, right? To me, that seems like going backwards. Now, you may argue, well, Blofeld was the main villain in 3 movies in a row there. You know, he was in You Only Live Twice, Honor, Majesty, Secret Service, Diamonds Are Forever. But it really was 3 completely different Blofelds. It was 3 completely different Blofelds, and it was like those 3 movies had nothing to do with each other. In a lot, you know, we talked about this again. If you haven't listened to John and I talk about, John and me talk about the Daniel Craig era or about these others, go back and listen to the whole Bond series because we talk about all this in very great detail. I just don't know that I want another. I just don't know what you would do with Blofeld after this. If there's a new Bond, right, if we get a new Bond actor, a new director, and a new Blofeld, or at that point, I guess you could have Christoph Waltz back and have him bedeviling a new Bond. I guess that'd be okay. I just don't think I want Daniel Craig, Christoph Waltz, Blofeld again, certainly not with Sam Mendes. Okay, so Bond walks off into the sunset with Madeleine Swann. That seems like a nice place for Bond to walk off into the sunset, at least for Daniel Craig's Bond to walk off into the sunset, maybe find some happiness, who knows, with Mr. White's daughter of all people. How strange would that be? And, you know, at that point, I guess I'll kind of sum up my feelings on the whole movie. I thought that this was, again, an A-minus in the sense that it had everything I could have wanted, but the execution was a little bit lacking. And so that brings me to my final thought or two, which is I blame Mendez, really. I think that Christoph Waltz was great. He could have been a lot better. He could have been a lot worse, right? He was very, very good. He could have been better. I'm left with the same sort of feeling with this movie that I had with Avengers Age of Ultron, which is that I got everything I could have ever wanted from characters and storylines that I've loved my entire life. And yet the execution in both cases was just not quite what it could have been. And here's another interesting parallel between Spectre and Avengers Age of Ultron. In both cases, you had a director that did generally, people said did a great job the first time. Again, I have issues with Skyfall, but most people thought that Joss Whedon did a great job with Avengers and Mendez did a great job with Skyfall. You have them coming back and bringing more of the lore, right? More of the history in, right? With Avengers, they brought in a lot of characters we hadn't seen before. Scarlet Witch, Vision, Quicksilver, Ultron, all that. With Spectre, you bring in Blofeld and the Spectre organization, all that. In both cases, that's great. But in both cases, I felt like the director maybe should have stepped out and let somebody else take over. The directing of that Martin Campbell does on Casino Royale to me is better in a lot of ways. Go back and watch Casino Royale and you'll see what I mean. There were a lot of parallels, I think. A lot of similarities overall between Avengers Age of Ultron this year and Spectre this year. And in both cases, they were sequels where a director returned, and I'm not sure they were well served by having the same director come back and kind of throw the kitchen sink in and leave us a little bit hollow at the end, okay? So my opinion of Avengers Age of Ultron has kind of declined a little bit since I did my review. I stand by all the stuff I said. It's an Avengers fan's dream come true, but I get how it doesn't work as well as a movie as it could have. And I think the same thing is true here. This is a Bond fan, this is a James Bond fan's dream come true with little bits and pieces from all kinds of movies. But as a standalone movie on its own, I'm not sure it couldn't have been executed better. I still feel like there's more I have to say, but I'm not exactly sure how to say it or how to put it into words, or how to enunciate it. I mean, I wanted to love it. I liked it a whole lot. I love a lot of the things that happen in it. But not completely thrilled. There were just so many moments in this movie, standalone moments, that are as good or better than anything we've seen in any Bond film to this point. So it's well worth your time, especially if you're a Bond fan. All right, that'll do it for this episode. This has run quite a bit longer than I expected. I had a lot to say about this movie. I hope some of this has made sense. This was my stream of consciousness reaction to it. The Rocket's going to get on out of here for another week, and we will see you all down the road, and I'm sure that James Bond will return.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.